Hello, I'm Ewan Spence, and welcome to the All About Symbian Insight podcast. It's Insight number 74, giving you their best views of the mobile and smartphone world with that penchant towards the Symbian operating system. Joining myself and you, as always, we have Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody.
And Steve Litchfield.
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah. And don't forget, you can always leave your comments as well, both online for everybody to read at www.allaboutsymbian.com. And we also appreciate all your emails, questions and thoughts as well coming in privately. And you can do that to insight@allaboutsymbian.com through your email as well. It's been an up and down week. Some big things, not a lot of little things, but one of the things that did catch me in the news was the announcement of Symbian SMP, announced in the Symbian Foundation blog. This is essentially Symbian running on multiple processors, and this allows such technical terms as load balancing, so the same task is shared amongst two processors. And of course the key thing is that it's running on these multiple processors are all able to access the same one piece of memory at the same time. So although you might think that running more than one processor is bigger in battery life, because of the load sharing and the technology, it actually saves battery life because the processors can run at a smaller speed, I'm assuming. And I just love the fact that this is showing that even though Symbian has got some of the most technical stuff and bits and pieces possible, it's hiding as much of it as possible from the developer and also the end user.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Ewan. Just to clarify this, this isn't sort of the announcement that Symbian is running on SMP. It's just the announcement that they've had one of the first sort of real world working examples. This is actually done by a team at ST Ericsson, which is of course the company that came out of the merger of Ericsson and ST Microelectronics, which are, again goes back a little bit further as well, but and they've been working with ARM and now have the operating running on a capable SMP configuration. And as you say, Ewan, the implications there are really, it's a dual thing about the processor capability but also the applicability on mobile, where when you're having multiple cores you can effectively switch off one core at a time. And that saves power, so that when you're doing sort of low processor intensity tasks, maybe updating a contact, you can just use one, and that uses much less power than having one processor running all the time. And if you're doing more complex stuff like decoding a multimedia file, a bit of codec, whatever, you can have multiple cores running. And there are also some efficiency savings in terms of extra multi-threading capabilities. We won't go into the deep details there. I think one of the interesting things to note here is it's consisting of the Sony, the ST Ericsson U8500 smartphone platform, which is of course the ARM Cortex A9 processor on board. And this is actually a single chip that contains both the application processor and baseband, as with other single chip processors. And that's a significant achievement in terms of what's been done elsewhere. Symbian is significantly ahead here. It's also got, as you'd expect, sort of the latest modem technology in it. That's HSPA, so HSDPA and H-Super. What can this actually do in terms of its capabilities? So when we start see this in phones, which isn't that long away, you know, we're probably talking less than 12 months in some senses. This is HD 1080p camcorder and video. That's a step up from the 720p that's running on the Omnia 3, which is sort of the OMAP 3 chipset. In theory, you could have 18 megapixel cameras with this processor. You could have you know, a lot of audio playback time. They're talking about 100 hours with a sort of fairly standard battery. And you could also, simultaneously to doing everything on the screen, you could put it out, TV out over HDMI. So this is you know, a significant step up from the current generation of processors. And it's exciting to see this because it's running properly. And actually having an optimized OS running SMP is something that hasn't really been achieved in the mobile world yet. And having it at this stage means that when we have Symbian 2 come out, which is basically now, looking forward 12 months' time, it's going to be another leap forward in what the phones are capable of doing. And doing it on a single chip also means it's going to be relatively inexpensive compared to the two-chip solution which the OMAP line is using.
And it's also nice to see that Symbian Foundation obviously have a long-term plan in mind as well, and they're continuing to push forward the stuff that's basically made Symbian OS the bullet points and usefulness that it is.
That's right, and, you know, it is pushing it forward because we're talking about things like, you know, hardware-accelerated 3D graphics with, you know, the OpenGL 2.0 on the OMAP things, but also the higher resolution displays, all of which are supported in the future versions of the Symbian Foundation platform, even, for example, having Touch UI on two displays. So I think it's very exciting news because it looks towards the future about building products that aren't just a step up on previous, but perhaps can go into new areas. So, you know, it's in one sense, it's very technical and quite boring news, but it's opening up the possibilities. This is the enabler that will build the next generation of mainstream products.
And speaking of mainstream products, moving away also from hardware into software, Google announced their mobile app for S60 last week. Steve, I understand you've been taking a look at this one in a little bit more depth.
I think both Rafe and I have, but I'll take the news as Rafe's just been chatting. Google mobile app is for S60 third edition at the moment. I dare say a fifth edition version will happen. And what it is you can picture the old Google search where you used to press the pencil key on, for example, an N95 home screen, it will bring up a search box and it will give you a quick way of searching Google, and it would remember your location, for example. And it was okay as far as it went, but it didn't work on devices without the pencil key on the front screen on the keypad, and it also didn't auto-sense your location, say you move away from your home. So what Google have done is they've taken the idea of enhancing this search application massively. They've brought in an alternative home screen hotkey, which is backspace for devices without a pencil key, which is more common these days. They've also put in the same geolocation system, that's cell tower and GPS, as in Google Maps, and it's the same engine. So the search utility will know where you are on the planet and will give you results relevant to that location. And in addition to all this, they've also put along the top of the screen shortcuts to their other mobile applications in case you don't know about them or want to switch them quickly or want to find out about updates for them. So it's really is an all-encompassing Google edition. I'm a bit of a Google fan, as you may know, and this is just the icing on the cake, really. A few minor updates to some of the applications I'm watching out for, but this Google mobile app is certainly a must for everybody.
Rafe, what are the strategic implications on this application? Because it looks to me like you could sit inside this Google app and never have to touch the S60 interface.
I think that's probably going a bit far, but certainly what it does do is deliver the Google services on the S60 platform in a much more compelling way because, I mean, Steve mentioned the way that there's application shortcuts. This means effectively you can press one shortcut off the home screen and get all the Google services, be that search, Gmail, YouTube, Picasa Web, and also significantly in some markets, Google has quite a lot of mobile services, maybe based around SMS, for example, in the States, and Orkut and as a sort of social network. And they're giving shortcut applications to those. A lot of those are then going off to web applications. Some of them are going off to the native S60 applications. I think Maps is the most notable one there. And I think, you know, this is where we're seeing the direct competition between Nokia's Ovi and Google's own service platform. And clearly it's going to be difficult for Google to compete directly with Nokia because you know, Nokia stuff is available out of the box. But for those who do want to get Google, it needs to be a premium experience as good as what you're getting from Nokia. And doing it through disparate applications, which may be hidden under an installation folder, it's a tricky one. But by doing this, they're direct access off the home screen, very obvious branding, and then dropping into something which makes it easy to access those Google services. And actually, in terms of getting a search out onto the web, this is, I think, probably the fastest way to do it on S60. You can use the sort of home screen search plugin that Nokia has, but that's also for searching the device, and a few extra clicks are required. So I do think this is quite interesting. It'll also be interesting to see if some of the non-Nokia S60 devices or Symbian Foundation devices going forward start using this approach, because you could bundle Google services with it quite effectively. And obviously it's early days, but it's the potential is there at least for it to be taken further to, if you like, have the Google suite of software on S60 just as you do on Android. So I think the strategic implications are that Google is still putting a lot of effort into addressing the S60 market, when in one sense you might say that they could just do it through web applications or basic Java applications, which I think is probably an indicator of they realize that this is a platform that's they need to target because it is the biggest one and it will be around for some time to come. And it also does offer a consolidation of what they've done before on the S60 platform. So, thumbs up from me as well, because it is very effective. even if it is a bit insular to Google itself, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. So interesting one to watch. I'll actually be more interested to see what they do next.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Samsung have pretty tight ties into Google. You remember the Google Maps, Google Mail, they were all embedded in the firmware of many S60 third edition devices from Samsung. And I'm sure we'll see a tighter integration of Google Mobile as well as things like YouTube in future Samsung S60 devices.
That's absolutely right. And the same thing with the Sony Ericsson Satio. Those applications were pre-installed again. And I think if that tight integration that I was talking about off the home screen actually just steps it up to the next level. You know, they're not icons within one of, you know, 50, 60 applications. This is, you know, premium space on the home screen. Now, whether Google can persuade Samsung or Sony Ericsson to have that on their own devices, what they certainly will be able to do, I would have thought, is have the application itself a sort of one-point access for Google services. And, you know, anything that simplifies it down is generally a good thing in terms of usability, encouraging people to try out and use those services.
Also hitting the streets, but this time in the more physical sense rather than over the internet, is Nokia's 5630 Express Music. It appears to be the budget version of in the music category of smartphones, a small 2.2-inch screen, but it runs micro SD. It's got the proper headphone jack at 3.5mm, 3-megapixel camera, dual LED flash. It appears to be the sort of standards, you know, this is what you get with a 60 phone. In the same way that something like the E75 is that for business, I think the 5630 is going to be the sort of basic model that we have for the mid to low budget range S60 phones. And of course, it's got its tight integration into the Nokia Music Store and the rest of the music and media that seem to be so attractive nowadays in the high street.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, with S60, Nokia has its high-end N-series and E-series products. And some of the sort of numbered devices tend to be overlooked. And the 5630 is actually the first one out of the new hardware platform, which is shared with devices like the E55, the E52. Also, I think it's it's the 5730, which is the QWERTY slide out. And in one sense, I think you can see the 5630 as kind of the consumer or the music focused version of the Nokia E52. It was announced just before MWC, and it is the Express Music tie-in that's important here. You know, with these lower-end handsets, it tends to be about the positioning within the sort of the mid-tier segment, which at 60 has massively increased in the last year. And because of the price point, you know, we're talking, you know, €200, £200. This means even on the cheaper contracts, it's going to be free. And as a pay-as-you-go handset, this will probably reach the £150 point. I don't think we're quite at the £100 price point with this, at least not yet. But it does a lot of things right. You know, it does have the GPS in it as well, the 3.5mm audio jack. And with the GPS, it's also got the magnetometer, the compass in it, which is standard across this new hardware platform. And there's actually an awful lot packed into this phone. I mean, it represents extremely good value. A real step up from the sort of previous generation, which was things like the 5320, which had the price was coming down, but did tend to lack just a little bit in the feature department. There are some questions about how well S60 transitions to this kind of mid-tier in terms of, is the screen size big enough to sort of be able to see and do everything? But in terms of value, this is, I think, quite a remarkable product. And I expect it to sell quite well without necessarily people realizing quite what they're getting their hands on. It is, of course, supported by the Ovi Store, although it's not shipping initially with the Ovi Store on board. I expect that to change by the time one of the firmware updates comes out later in the year. But this phone has largely been ignored since it was announced, and even now it's started shipping. It's available in various Nokia shops, notably in, I think, Finland, Germany and Italy. But it's been rather underappreciated, so I just wanted to flag it up in this podcast as something that we should just pay a little bit of attention to, because for all the excitement around devices like the N97 or the N86 at the high end, S60 has a very significant advantage over its competitors in the way it's already in the mid-tier space, and devices like this are only going to increase its influence there. And it really is pushing down against S40, and I think we'll come back to this in future podcasts, maybe at the end of this with one of the reader questions, which is, you know, future direction of S60. So it's a significant one in terms of Nokia's strategy, even if it's not the most exciting product for high-end users to look at.
And you spoke there, of course, of the Nokia N97, which is starting to trickle out on the internet and into the streets over last week and into next week as well. We will probably have an in-depth review and lots of coverage, but let's keep it short and sweet in this podcast in terms of review. Steve, would you buy one?
I think I would be tempted, but there are a few things putting me off. I have to admit, when I saw the N97's specifications and saw the design, I like most people, thought, that is it. It's my perfect device. But there are a few gotchas. So yes, I want one, but I still don't think Nokia have put enough RAM in this. Now, this has been commented on by Rafe and myself and other arenas. And for most people, 95% of users, having 50 megabytes or so of free RAM will be absolutely fine. They're not going to run out of RAM. But the problem is that the N97 is a flagship device and will be picked up, certainly in the early days, by power users and early adopters. And they're the ones who will be going to big web pages, running big games, running multitasking 4 or 5 programs. And they're the ones who are going to run out of RAM. And the whole thing will get a reputation for being underpowered or slow. It's a shame. If the cost of an extra 128 megabytes of dynamic RAM, I really don't see why they skimped here. The second disappointment, of course, and very briefly, because people get fed up with me mentioning it, is the fact that there's only dual LED flash. Again, I would have expected an 8 megapixel sensor and Xenon for a real flagship. And with those two parameters, with those two characteristics, I think that would have been enough to really push certainly myself over the edge.
I suppose the big question there is how much would that cost? Certainly the Xenon flash would require a huge more amounts just in terms of physical space for the electronics, wouldn't it, Steve?
It's only another millimeter or so, Ewan. The 6220 is a fairly small phone and that manages it. But I don't want to go off into another Xenon rant. I want to concentrate on things that are specific to the N97. One other thing. Nokia's keyboard they put into the N97, I criticised it a bit on my first impressions review for being a bit small, a bit fiddly, the space bar's in, quote, the wrong place. The reason they've had to cramp it is because they wanted to put a D-pad in. They couldn't put a D-pad on the face because that would have meant making the screen smaller. So they really are coming up against physical limitations at each point. The screen's got to be nice and large, and it's got to be a touch screen. So the D-pad has to go on the bottom sliding part. If there's a D-pad, you can't have as much space for the keyboard. Because of the hinge and the fact that it's a touch screen, which means it can't topple over every time you touch the screen, means that the screen has to meet the base of the unit roughly halfway along, which means you've only got half the base to play with for the keyboard itself. So the keyboard is cramped into approximately 35% of the base area, which is not very much at all. And I did some QWERTY speed testing between the 5800 with its virtual keypad on roughly the same size screen against the N97. And believe it or not, there wasn't much in it. And I have to question, if you're going to put a QWERTY keyboard into a device, there's got to be a really good reason. Like, it's much faster and much easier to use than a virtual equivalent, which you can wipe off in a microsecond just by rewriting the pixels on the screen. I don't think the N97 is that much better than a virtual keyboard. But all that aside, keep watching All About Symbian for the detailed reviews. Yes, I do want one. I do hope I end up with one. I hope I get to trial one for at least a couple of months.
I suppose the other issue about the N97 is it's coming along at the same time as the next generation iPhone and also the Palm Pre as well. Can it stand those head-to-head comparisons, Rafe?
I think it's very difficult without actually trying out these devices for a prolonged period of time. And as we're recording this, the Apple announcement is going to be this afternoon. But I actually think you also have to consider that all these devices, you know, comparing them head-to-head is kind of a power user thing to do, and they do each have their sort of uniqueness. So, for example, I think the iPhone is focused on a different market in one sense to the N97. Clearly, there is going to be crossover between the types of users wanting these devices. But a lot of the Apple appeal is around kind of the appeal of the Apple brand. From a technical point of view, the N97 is superior in most departments. There are some exceptions that you could come up against, probably most notably in gaming. But things like, for example, call quality, one of the most basic attributes, you know, Nokia is still ahead of the competition there. I think actually one of the closest competitors to the N97 in many ways is the Touch Pro 2, because that marries the same form factor as the N97, whereas, you know, looking at the iPhone, maybe the HTC Magic as well, and even to an extent the Palm Pre, they're all much more based around tablet-type devices. And yes, the Pre has a keyboard, but it's not that same full-size QWERTY slide-out. And just to loop back to what Steve was saying about the keyboard, it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of the keyboard with the N97 is about the perception, is how it's perceived. And when you actually try out a device, you often find yourself using it in different ways to that which you originally imagined. And having the QWERTY keyboard on it just changes the way people look at the device. And, you know, more people will consider it because of it. You know, whereas something like the iPhone, it is very much the tablet-centric usage model. With the N97, I mean, Steve is the one that's had it for the last 5 days or so. Whereas when I've been using it, you do tend to use it more like a kind of little laptop than, you know, a tablet-esque device. So I think it's a question we'll have to come back to. I'm looking forward to actually trying out some of these devices. I have tried an HTC Magic, and no doubt the iPhone will be out before too long. And the Touch Pro 2, when I saw it, did impress me, most especially because of the work HTC had put into the software. But I hope to be able to borrow one and report back on some of the usage constraints there.
Yeah, I've got a Touch Pro 2 arriving tomorrow morning, guys, actually. So what I'll do is put up on the site a comparison of the two. But just on the Touch Pro 2, one difference there in the form factor, which I think may be important for the target market, is that the Touch Pro 2 doesn't put in a D-pad because there is no gaming pretensions there, which means it can afford the full width of the base for the keyboard and the different mechanism. I don't think it's quite as elegant and clever a mechanism, but it's rather cruder. But the mechanism on the Touch Pro 2 does give slightly more base area depth-wise to the QWERTY keyboard, so you get more rows of keys. So that's one distinction, but there'll be more on that from me tomorrow.
Right, that's possibly enough from us driving the discussions, as said at the top of the show. It's always great to hear your opinions about the podcast. We've had some feedback and specifically questions into the team here at the All About Simeon Insight podcast. Rafe, do you want to take the first one?
Yes, I've got some questions here from Mark, and the first one I think is one that Steve will be well positioned to answer. And he's talking about the fact that it's been reported that multi-touch resistive touchscreens has been developed, but he also hears that Nokia may be getting in some capacitive screen devices for release later in the year, and has been reading our pros and cons, listening on the podcast as well. And he wants to know, what's our personal take on the future of touchscreen devices for Nokia's flagship devices?
I'll take that first. I think they may come around to a capacitive device, but I wouldn't hold my breath, and I don't believe it's that important. I know there are advantages to capacitive touchscreens. There are also advantages for resistive. And again, I refer interested listeners to an article I read a couple of months ago on the site where I go into exhaustive detail of all the pros and cons of each. Suffice it to say that there's no clear winner. It depends on which manufacturer is making it and which target countries it's aimed at, which styles of gesture input or touch input they require, what temperatures involved, what humidities. There are an awful lot of factors. So take the capacitive rumor with a pinch of salt.
And there's also the sheer practical difficulties. If you're wearing gloves, you can't use any of the capacitive screens. So you either have to leave your phone as it is or take your hand out your glove and have your hand freezing cold in the Scottish summer to actually do something on a capacitive screen. Whereas with the resistive screen, you can just pick up any old stylus and away you go.
Yeah, well, I mean, personally, I feel the glove argument's a little bit weak on resistive versus capacitive screens. But I think the point here is that, as Steve said precisely, you know, it really depends on what the device is, what the target market is. Mark here was particularly asking about touchscreens on flagship devices. Now, I think we will continue to see a mix, but I do think there may well be an emphasis on capacitive touchscreens, simply because that has become associated with the high-end devices. Now, you may argue that resistive screens, as I would do, there isn't an awful lot of difference, but again, it becomes a perception thing. And while multi-touch isn't a big deal on S60 or Symbian Foundation at the moment, basically because it's not supported, it could well become in the future. And with a lot of the gestures coming forward, both either on-screen, in particular, obviously, for touchscreen devices, capacitive touch may become more important, but it's difficult to, take this and give it a definitive answer. I think we may well see some Nokia devices, not necessarily running the Symbian Foundation, that have capacitive screens in the future. But if going slightly off the park, and this is going forward maybe 5-10 years or even more, no, let's keep it realistic, next 3 to 5 years, the difference between resistive and capacitive will largely go away, simply because I think actually touching the devices may not necessarily be the primary way you interact with your device. It may be just having your fingers above the device itself. Whether you actually touch it, we'll have to wait and see. There may be some other kind of sensing going on. So the idea that you sort of wave your hand above the device, or you're sort of doing things virtually in the air, I mean, it's referred to as the Minority Report style that was seen in the film of the same name. And I think that's a distinct possibility for mobile going forward. Mark did have one other question, and this was with S60 and MAMO. Are they on some kind of collision course? And I'm sure this is to do with the fact there's been several rumours around MAMO and what's coming in the future. It's quite clear that Nokia have continued to invest in the MAMO platform, and they're continuing to invest in the S60 and the Symbian Foundation platform. You know, they've taken out very significant loans and continue to do very significant development on the Symbian Foundation, but at the same time they are putting money into MAMO. Now there's been some speculation around MAMO replacing Symbian Foundation, and clearly I think if you read the tea leaves carefully, that's not the case. What it is fair to say is that MAMO is going to stage something of a comeback, probably in high-end devices, and it's not necessarily going to be purely in the internet tablet form factor. And I think this is probably a result of the fact we're seeing a merger between mobile phones and laptops, a kind of new convergence, one more step along that road. And it's possible to see a new category of devices which move away from the ancestry of phones and more towards the laptop computer. And I think that's where MAMO may come in. And there's been several blogs about this. David Wood of the Symbian Foundation has written about it, how MAMO can almost be an insurance policy for Nokia in case something doesn't quite work out with the Symbian Foundation. I think you can also see it, you know, MAMO as a way of addressing a sort of an emerging market, which is kind of the crossroads where there are mid devices, netbooks, smart books, high-end mobile phones with the big touchscreens, and that kind of instant-on mobile computer experience is becoming quite a hot area in the next few years. And there's a certain amount of fairness in saying that S60 is coming up for the mobile phone market and isn't necessarily in the best position to address that particular market segment, while at the same time it's going down towards the mid-tier as well. So do I think there's going to be a collision between S60 and MAMO? Yes, there is going to be some overlap in the sort of high-end S60 devices versus MAMO devices, but I think a lot of the emphasis on S60, at least in the coming years, will also be in the mid-tier, so I don't expect it to be sort of a one-for-one replacement. And in some senses, I don't see it as anything different to the way that S60 devices have eaten into the sort of share of what might have previously been done by PDAs or even laptop computers. You see people increasingly now saying, I carry around my E71 or presumably going forward the N97 instead of bringing my laptop with me because it's good enough. There is, I think, space between the sort of smartphone market as it exists now and the laptop market, as has been shown, I think, by the netbook. So there is going to be a certain amount of collision, but it's not a simple question of MAMO replacing or whatever. I think it's more about the expansion of sort of the convergence in that particular market segment. So I think I probably answered the question there, but I do know that Steve also has a user question.
Yes, from BMR68 on Twitter, saying, when, oh when, is there going to be a decent ebook reader for Symbian 5th edition? And a question I wholeheartedly endorse. You've been playing with Mobi Pocket for 3rd edition and then trying it on 5th edition, and there were a few gotchas, weren't there?
There's actually quite a few numbers of gotchas. The two big ones are certainly on the 5800. If you maximize the screen up, then it's actually wanting you to press the star key to minimize back down so you can get your menu bars and your top bar. The problem is, for you to actually get to the star key, you need to bring up the virtual keyboard, which means you actually need to bring up one of those top or bottom bars on the 5800 to actually do it. There's no actual way, if you've accidentally maximized the screen, to bring it down again. Now, that's almost a showstopper, but just about livable through. The big killer is it in certain books, and certainly using the PRC book format that I use, it doesn't save the page of the book that you're on. So you have to leave it open in the background at all times. And if you have to switch it off or process switches off that task, you lose your place in the novel and it puts you back at the very top. And that is, unfortunately, a showstopper. I was hoping that they would get their act together when they see the success that Amazon had made of the ebook Kindle reader before you actually realize that Amazon has bought up pretty much most of the ebook readers out there, no matter the platform. They, my understanding is they do MobiPocket. They've obviously got Audible for audiobooks. They've taken up various of the older PAM platforms as well. So it will need a company to actually come in fresh and write the client and source the content. And you, to be honest, I think our best hope, although it's incredibly long term, would be the guys at QuickOffice to support one of the ebook formats in their word processors, read only version. But
I'd like to throw out a challenge for any, there must be lots of developers for S60 who listen to this podcast, and who, for whom adapting code from S60 third edition isn't that hard to adapt for fifth edition with a larger screen and a touch interface. And there are quite a few sort of beta quality or alpha quality ebook readers for S60 third edition. And it surely it's not beyond the realms of possibility for one of those, just one of those, to be ported and adapted to just read public domain PRC and PDB ebooks as you and I read. I really think that's doable, and I haven't got the skills to do it. Hopefully someone listening has.
Yeah. We've already seen with something like the Gravity application for Twitter that an application that takes care over the user interface on top of basic functionality doesn't take that much extra time. And the how to use an ebook online is pretty standard. I'm sure that Steve and certainly I would be more than happy to guide you through making a good user interface for it. And our services as testers are definitely at anybody's disposal if they would like to make one.
I mean, it's interesting what you're saying here, guys. I mean, I think there's a twin question here, one of which is the traditional ebook reader that uses the traditional formats like PRC you were talking about. And I honestly don't see a very big market for that just because it's too complicated and long-term to use. I mean, yes, there's definitely a niche interest, and I'd certainly anticipate a developer coming along and putting something onto S60 5th edition sooner or later. As you say, there are quite a few out there that have done things for S60 3rd edition. I don't think we'll see any development from MobiPocket. As you say, Amazon have bought them. They're doing their Kindle stuff now. But I think with the OviStore out there, there's every chance that Amazon in the future, especially if they launch the Kindle experience into Europe, create a Kindle application for S60 or for the Symbian Foundation. And that way you'd be able to read the Kindle ebooks and do the buying on the device, get all the download working for you. Because I think a device like the N97 or the Omnia HD, or I should call it the 8910 HD, have big enough screens and are bright enough that you could actually have a pretty good reading experience on them, especially if you then sort of use maybe volume keys for scrolling or something like that. And there will be others who will look at the ebook space, and they would be stupid not to at least consider the Symbian Foundation platform, given that there are an awful lot of devices out there, will continue to be, and at least for the Nokia devices in the form of the OviStore, a pretty easy way to get to market. I think a lot of the problems before with ebooks on these devices have been around screen size. You know, the non-touch devices have the smaller screens. It's also been one of distribution, and so it's not really worth going to do it until you've got the distribution channel. So I think those twin developments of OviStore and the devices with larger screens make it more likely we'll actually see a Kindle-like service or a MobiPocket-like service come along. So I think it's just a question of being patient. If you're just after the PRC reader, I'm pretty confident that will come along before too long.
There we go. Community, don't let us down. I think that's what we're trying to say there.
Yeah. I think we're trying to say we better wrap up, Ewan.
Oh, right. Okay, then. We shall go away. It's been such a busy time. Your comments and more questions next week, if we can squeeze them in before the end, are always welcome, as we said. Email into us. It only remains for me to thank you all out there for listening. To thank Steve Litchfield.
Hello and goodbye.
And Rafe Blandford.
Goodbye, everybody.
And everybody else who makes the podcast possible. My name's Ewan Spence. We'll catch you in the next Insight. Ta-ra.